Hey guys, what is up? It is me. My name is Cliff. I am your host of Being Famous Podcast. Guys, we are moving right along with the podcast. This is episode number 6. If it's your first time listening, welcome. Glad to have you. I suggest you go back and listen to previous episodes, which can be heard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and my webpage. If you're a returning listener, then welcome back. If you would like more information about myself and this podcast, please visit my webpage at beingfamouspodcast.com. There you can leave comments, subscribe to get all the latest podcast news, and listen to all episodes, as well as learn more about each guest. Facebook and Instagram are at Being Famous Podcast. If you're out there listening in the podcast world and you like what you hear, please, guys, leave me a comment and a rating. That would be greatly appreciated. Wow, y'all, this is really cool for me as I am a huge fan of The Church, by far my favorite band of all time. Over the past several years, I've seen them perform in Asheville, Chapel Hill, Boston, Nashville, and right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. When they tour the States, I go, no questions asked. Grab a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, a beer, a glass of wine, whatever it may be, as this should be very entertaining. Without further ado, buckle up, guys. Here we go. Let's welcome to the podcast, calling in all the way from Coogee, Australia, which is a suburb of Sydney, founding member of The Church, and arguably the greatest lyricist to ever live. Yeah, I said it and we'll talk about it. Steve Kilby. Steve, how you doing, man?
Yeah, hi, Cliff. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Absolutely, Steve. Really do appreciate you coming on. Let's get right to it. We got a lot to talk about. Tell me what a typical day for you is like in Coogee.
Well, I've got a sea pool. There's a sea pool here in Coogee. And if the tides are right, I usually go and have a swim first thing in the morning. At the moment, the tides are wrong. And it's too, the water's, you can't get a decent swim in the morning, so I'll wait till the afternoon. I have three daughters that live in Sydney. I try to catch up with them. I have some very good friends. You can see me with one of my very best friends on Instagram on my story, George, the arranger and conductor. We meet up and have swims and talk about music. I do a lot of interviews and writing articles. I try to get a bit of painting done. I try and meditate. I try and get a bit of walking done. And sometimes I just goof off and don't get anything done. I just sit around going, looking at my phone.
Yeah, man, I get it. Sounds like me on certain days. Steve, let's get to the latest church news. Peter Koppus is out and has left the band. Is that correct?
Peter Koppus left the band, yeah.
Any particular reason why?
Musical and personal differences. He's still working on business for us. He's still a member of our business team, and he is handling all the publishing and recording deals that he was involved in. There's a lot of mutual respect. He is an incredible guitarist, but he had had enough, and he made that clear that he had enough, and he left. And you could imagine, I mean, working for 40 years on a gig is a long time, and he and I had even been playing before that, so no one can think it was sort of a fly-by-night thing, and he did it for a long time, and he was bloody great at what he did, and the church wouldn't have been the church without him. Far more important to the church than Marty ever was. I mean, Marty, to tell the truth, Marty didn't really come into his own until we started making Heyday. Up until then, Marty was sort of just doing what he was asked to do. A lot of people don't realize that. And I saw an interview with Marty where he actually had the gall to say, someone was interviewing him and he said, oh, yeah, the singer used to come in with ideas of what he wanted. And then me and Pete would figure them out. No, Marty. Do you really think that? What was really dumb was I used to come in with cassettes and go, here are the songs. You play this and Peter, you do this. And I let whoever did the solo could do the solo they wanted. And really, the first four albums, I kind of wrote on my own, give or take little bits and pieces, but I kind of wrote them, and I wrote all the guitar parts and had it all figured out, and they sort of had leeway in their solos and stuff, but mainly Marty did what he was asked to do. And then on Heyday, I threw it open and I said, we are now a fully functioning ensemble, and what I did got us there, and now I'm throwing it open. And that's when Marty really came into his own. And I could never take away what a brilliant and intuitive guitarist Marty was. And Heyday, Starfish, you know, from then on in, he was fully contributing. But up until that point, he was pretty doing what I asked him to do. And developing his sound. But when we started with Peter, Peter already had a well-developed sound. Peter's sound was Peter's sound. I didn't come up with that. Peter came up with that. And the band wouldn't have been nearly as good without Peter. And then by 1985, Marty had come into his own, and we had the Church Mark II, where those two guys, the interplay between them was what they were thinking of. It wasn't me. But still, I was always the editor. I was always the guy going, yes, we're going to use this bit. We're going to use that. That riff you just wrote, that's the one we're going to use. I was always the overseer. But from Heyday up until when Marty left, and until Peter left, their guitar parts were pretty much their own. And they were both bloody brilliant guitarists, and they were completely opposite to each other. Peter was a very knowledgeable musician who knew exactly what he was doing and would write music down. And Marty was sort of an intuitive guy that would just pick up a guitar and play stuff. And I would never take away from either of them what they did. They were both, I was very lucky to have them. On the other hand, they were very lucky to have me. They were lucky to have a songwriter who knew what he was doing and had already written a bunch of songs. And when the band started, I already had a complete vision of what this band should be, and I'd already written bunches of songs. And we were all lucky to have each other. And it pains me when I see people say, because Marty leaves or because Peter leaves or because anybody leaves, that I shouldn't be the church. I was already the church. I am the church. If it's me and your grandmother playing the flute, that's the church. The church is me and whoever I play with. It's not me as a bass player and a singer hoping to have other people help me do the church. The church is me, and I want to make that clear. And the people I play with, I greatly respect. And the people I've got now, Jeffrey and Ian and Ashley, who's just joined, and of course, Tim Powells, who's become like my lieutenant, helping me achieve my vision very much. Very important. I greatly respect them, but it's me and I am the guiding light. This is my brainchild, and it always will be my brainchild, even if they all go. And I started with a whole bunch of new people. It's the church. That's my brand name. I'm not going to fucking relinquish it. Because people leave.
And there you have it. Straight to the point and no BS. Typical Steve Kilby. I like it. You said a lot there, Steve. Marty, of course, being Marty Wilson Piper, who joined the band in 1980, left in 2013. Here's the deal, Steve. This is the way that I see it, man. Without you, there is no church.
Well, thank you.
Period. End of story.
That's how it is. I can really understand people have their favorite members, I can understand people love what Marty did. I can understand what people love what Peter did, and if they don't want to see us anymore because they're not there, I accept that. But they are not the church. I'm the church. The church is my baby, and they were members of the church, and they contribute a fucking hell of a lot. But the church will go on without them. The church has amassed a huge body of work. The church is my vehicle. I thought of the church. I'm the one. It's not bragging or throwing down the gauntlet. It's like Walt Disney. He thought of Disney, you know, Disney Productions. There's all these other people, and these people did animation. But at the end, at the top of the whole thing, the buck stops with Walt Disney when he was alive, and he said, we will do this and we won't do this and I'm choosing this. And that's how it is with me. The church is my brainchild that I worked on my whole life. And it will go on with who I say it goes on with. And that's not to say I don't love the musicians I play with and I don't respect them. And I'm not a fucking lead guitarist. I don't play lead guitar. I need people to do that for me. But the spirit of the church, I'm the keeper of the flame. So that's enough about that. But I don't fucking care. If you don't think it's the church without Peter or Marty, don't come. But don't write on my own social media page that it isn't the church or that I'm just doing this to squeeze money out of it or whatever it is. They have to understand I put over 40 years work in this. Like, I've been dreaming this up my whole life, how I wanted my ideal band to be, and I ain't going to stop because somebody else wants to stop. I respect that Marty had enough, and I respect that Peter had enough and they left. It's not my fault that they wanted to leave, but I ain't stopping because of them.
Yeah, and for church fans like myself, I mean, that's great to know that the church will continue to carry on. Steve, since Marty Wilson Piper left the band, have you spoken to him?
No. No, I don't want to speak to him. What have I got to say?
I'm not real sure. That's why I'm asking, man. I would assume not much, but I thought I would ask.
I don't know. He still gets his royalties. You know, there's no funny business going on. Every record he plays on, he earns his money. And Peter, you know, Peter is overseeing that. Richard Plugue gets his money. Peter gets his money. Marty gets his money. But I don't have anything to say to them. You know, they're gone. We weren't mates. I wasn't. They're not my mates. We had issues, you know. I felt they were very unappreciative of the fact that they never fucking would have been anywhere if I hadn't written all those songs. And then when they joined the band, it wasn't easy. And I made a lot of mistakes. And, of course, when I was a heroin addict, they really carried me through. And they sort of stood by me. And I was pretty useless for 10 years. I was a real liability. But no, I don't care if I ever speak to any of them ever again. They did their bit. We did what we did. We made some beautiful music. We played some great shows. And I wish them all the luck in the world. But I've got nothing to say to them. That's for sure. We're not friends. We're not friends, and we never were. That was an illusion. And most bands aren't friends. And if you read Keith Richards' book, he's fucking paying out on Jagger the whole way. Even little jokes, and, you know, we all used to call him Brenda, and he didn't know he was called Brenda. And, you know, he'd come in the studio and they go, Ronnie Wood go, boy, that Brenda's a bitch. And Keith go, yeah. And Jagger had no idea that, you know, those guys were doing that shit to me too. There was a lot of stuff going on, and we were colleagues, and we worked together, and we got a lot done, and we wrote a lot of good music. And now they're gone. I don't want to see them or hear from them ever again. I don't give a fuck. Good, but I wish them luck, and I'd be very sad to hear something had happened to them, but I don't want them ringing me up on my birthday or anything. You know, it's fucking over.
All right, well, there you have it. So, Steve, you're telling me that throughout all the years of the church, you guys were never friends.
No, we never were. No, they never were. Look, I got to say here, I was quite an arrogant little bastard. I didn't always go, oh, please, can you do this? Or please, can you do that? I might have gone, here's your part, play that, do this. I've written a song, we're going to play it. This is how it goes, do it. And maybe I should have approached things differently. I did a few interviews where I was very arrogant, and someone said, you know, would you ever sing the other guy's lyrics? And I go, why would I fucking sing their lyrics? You know, I don't think they're lyricists. I don't think they're songwriters. I'm a vocational songwriter. I was writing songs. I was thinking about writing songs when I was 4 years old. I wrote my first songs at 10. I wrote 1,000 songs before the church formed. Those guys were guitarists, and they started writing songs after they'd been in the church a few years and saw how I was doing it. There's a difference. My vocation isn't being a singer or a bass player. My vocation was to be a songwriter. and a lyricist.
Yeah, and a damn good one at that. And we'll talk about that in just a bit, Steve. But it just sounds like, man, it sounds like they had issues with you. You had issues with them. I mean, it sounds pretty much just like your typical band drama. Would that be a good way to describe you guys?
I think we're all a bunch of cunts to each other. They weren't friends with each other. They weren't friends with me. No one was friendly with anybody. You know, there were like moments of camaraderie and there was kind of us against the world. But in our days off, we certainly didn't hang out together.
That's pretty interesting, Steve. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Because I believe the perception there would be, because you guys are a band, you're automatically friends, which is obviously not the case. But here's the interesting thing. You guys are the church. You're writing great music. You're releasing great music. You guys are touring. So
yeah. That doesn't mean you like each other.
Sure. And I understand that. And you guys obviously aren't the first band out there that didn't get along with one another. But I find it impressive that you guys weren't friends. You weren't getting along. Yet you were still able to accomplish what you did and carry on as a band.
We weren't always not getting along either. But there was always a bit of intrigue and a bit of, you know, he drank my drink, he took my girlfriend, he trod on my toes, he wouldn't lend me an amp, he wouldn't, you know, there was always some argy bargy going on. There was always a bit of, it wasn't a brotherhood of pals. And I don't think most bands are. I mean, look at that fucking Metallica thing where they're all having therapy. You know, bands aren't, but people like to think bands are all a big bunch of friends and a gang, but they're not. They're colleagues, just like anybody, four guys running an accountancy business or four lawyers. You know, they're all working together for the common good, but, you know, whether they're socializing after hours or stuff, we weren't. And I had no desire. There's things about all of them I didn't like, and I know there are a lot of things about me they didn't like. The guy I liked the most was Plugi.
Plugi, of course, being Richard Plug, former drummer who joined the band in 1981, then left around 1990. Steve, I've hung out with you a few times, and you have told me some Richard Plug stories. I tell you what, man, that guy sounded like a complete character. Do you still talk to him?
If I saw him, I'd talk to him. He's a bit nutty. I'm too old for fucking games and subtext and innuendos and people implying stuff. So, you know, if you're not going to be nice to me, I don't want to really know about you anymore. I'm not up for any more. When I was a young man, I was very argumentative. If someone wanted to bring on an argument, I was ready to argue. Now I can't be bothered. If you're not going to be pleasant, I'll be pleasant. If you're not going to be pleasant to me, I don't want to meet you. That's pretty much how I feel. So if one of them rang me up and was being pleasant and said, I just want to ring up, and I go, okay, yeah, how are you going? But I don't think that's going to happen. We've all saw enough of each other, and the Four Musketeers days is over.
Yeah, man. Part of it, I suppose. Steve, how would you describe yourself today, the current Steve Kilby?
I'm pretty much, you know, I write songs and I go around the world performing them, but I'm a pretty ordinary guy. I love my daughters. I'm a good friend. I'm generous. If I go out to dinner, I like to pay the bill. I give to charities. If I see anybody in the street that's hanging out for money, I'll always give it to them. I'm not a bad guy. I'm not a terrible. I am egotistical. I am narcissistic, but I'm not a narcissist. I'm not a sociopath. And there's a difference. I've always been a bit narcissistic. I've always liked talking about myself and looking at myself and listening to myself. But I'm not a sociopathic sort of controlling person that likes to hurt people. And I believe, you know, as the years gone by, I'm fairly compassionate and I'm fairly reasonable and I'm fairly approachable. And, you know, if I'm standing outside the bus and someone says, will you go in and get Tim's autograph? I'll go in the bus and get Tim's autograph and come out and give it to him. You know, I'm not some fucking you know, I'm not some unapproachable, and you know, I'm pretty just a normal sort of, as you know, I'm just a normal bloke. I'm just a normal geezer.
Yeah, I do know that. And I like the term geezer. I would agree with that. Definitely. You're definitely a normal bloke, Steve. You mentioned it earlier, Steve, you being a lyricist, you being a songwriter. I mentioned it in the intro of this podcast where I said you could be, you know, maybe arguably, quite possibly the greatest lyricist ever. What do you think?
I'm up there. I'm never going to, you know, I can never be, you can never be as great as Lennon or Dylan because they invented the whole thing and they inform what I do. So I'm always their disciple. But I think I'm a, I think I write pretty good lyrics, yeah. They work on lots of levels and I know a lot about language and poetry and I've been thinking about this and analysing it my whole life. You know, I just wasn't 23 and I suddenly went, oh, I'm going to write some songs. I need lyrics. What am I going to write lyrics? No, I've been thinking about it my whole life. So, yeah, I'm a pretty, I mean, it's very immodest to say, yeah, I'm the greatest lyricist. But I am, you know, if that is my strongest suit for sure, is writing words.
Yeah, man. I mean, without question. Would you say, Steve, you know, I know rankings are kind of subjective and whatnot, but top 10?
Yeah, I'm in the top 10. I don't, you know, look, there's Dylan, there's Lennon, there's Paul, there's Bolan, there's Bowie. After that, I'm in there somewhere.
Yeah, and Bolan being Mark Bolan, former lead singer of the group T-Rex. Steve, when it comes to the business side of the church, how involved are you in the business decisions of the band?
When it comes to business, I don't have much say. I don't have much to do with that. It's not really my forte. But when it's creative decisions, I try to have the last word on that, you know. And I will, you know, I'm approachable. If people say, look, we really don't think we should do this, we think we should do that, I'll listen to that. But in the end, you know, I'm the guy who decides what will be the church, you know, musically and, you know.
Gotcha. So let me ask you this.
Yeah.
So let's say you guys have a new CD coming out, which you do, by the way. You guys record, as an example, Steve, 20 songs. You guys decide that of those 20 songs, 10 songs are going to get put on the CD. Who decides what songs get released?
Well, everybody can have a say. And everybody can say, we really hope this one goes on and we hope that one goes on. There was a bit of tension between me and Peter on the last records. He really wanted some things on there that I didn't, and I acquiesced to that. But from now on, now he's gone, it will be up to me. But in consultation with my colleagues, and if they all came to me and said, we really think you're making a mistake with this one and we want this one on and we want this one off, I would really consider carefully. I wouldn't just be an autocratic tyrant going, it's got to be done my way. It'd be like, I work in consultation, but in the end, it appears to me that I must have the final say.
And that last record that you mentioned, Steve, that you had some disagreement over with Peter Kappas, Man, Woman, Life, Death, Infinity, one of my favorite church records of all time. As we mentioned earlier, Peter Kappas is out. Ashley Naylor is in. Steve, tell me about Ashley Naylor.
Ashley has been a guitar slinger for a long time. He's got his own band called Even. I met him years ago doing this Rockwiz TV show. He was the musical director of the David Bowie thing. He's not just a guitarist. He plays piano. He plays drums. He plays bass. He's an expert on all things to do with pop music and rock and roll. And he's a very likable guy. He's quite a lot younger than me. And was a fan, like Ian and Jeffrey. They were fans of the church. So they approached the whole thing with more respect than Marty and Peter might have had, you know. So these guys, they're all glad to be in the church, and they want to keep the church going, and they want to keep the church the church. And they're all very nice people, and they are my friends. So far, Ian's definitely my friend, and Jeffrey has been my friend for a long time. I would consider him a very good friend. And Ashley is a guy who I'd be really happy to hang out with after hours as well. And Tim, of course. Tim and I spend a lot of time together. I go out to Tim's studio. We work on records. We talk about philosophy and everything. So at the moment, we're all mates.
Awesome. Good to know, Steve. Hopefully things stay on the up and up. You mentioned a few names. Tim being Tim Pauls, the drummer. Jeffrey being Jeffrey Kane, Mobile, Alabama native, also former member of the group Remy Zero. You guys did some work a few years back as Isidore, which was fantastic music. And of course, Ian Hogue. Steve, did you know Ian prior to him joining the church?
Ian I'd met when he was in Powderfinger. I didn't know him really well, but I knew he was the sort of guy I wanted. I didn't want some complicated, argumentative guy with a load of hang-ups.
Sure, certainly makes sense to me. And I've spoken to Ian a few times, a very cool guy. Steve, you got some new members in the band or guys that haven't been around very long. What do you think these guys make of you?
These guys who are in it now, they've only known me since I've been the nice, kind old guy that I am now. I keep my head down. I don't create problems. I don't pick on up. I don't start arguments. I don't get out of it and, you know, abandon my duty or go missing in action. I'm on time. I'm relatively sober. You know, I don't go on stage pissed or unbelievably stoned, or I don't take fucking hard drugs on stage. And, you know, it's a kind of a, at the moment, it's a very workable and easy situation. There are no conflicts and there's no baggage about sort of what happened in the past. And it quite frankly, it was a relief when that finally all ended. And now it's a new band. And, you know, when I'm on tour, I'm very quiet. I don't get in people's faces. I'm usually I'm one of the first ones to go to bed at the end of the night. I played a three-hour show. I'm fucking knackered. I get in my bunk and I go to sleep. And usually when we get to the next town, I wait for Tim to get up. And then Tim and I walk around and find a Starbucks. And we chat about things. And, you know, sometimes we all have a laugh. But I pretty much keep to myself. And I'm not usually doing much of anything. I'm pretty quiet and well-behaved, I think.
Yeah, man, sounds pretty normal, right? I mean, coffee, perform, sleep,
yeah,
hang out with the guys a little bit, and yeah, just pretty normal stuff, right?
Yeah, I'm just an ordinary bloke, you know? I'm just an ordinary bloke. I want to hang out with people I like and people who like me. I don't want to have the past dragged up. I don't want to be – I know I was an arrogant little snot when I was 25, but I'm not anymore, and I'm just a regular bloke, and I'm interested in regular things, you know, and I'm not difficult, you know. I'm not pulling a trip on anybody, whoever I meet. You know, when we do those meet and greets, I try and be kind and nice and accommodating with everybody, and, you know, that old guy I was no longer exists, and thank God, you know. And it's when you're 65, you should be gracious and you should be venerable and you should be respectful, and you expect a bit of respect and stuff to come back. So, you know, if you approach me just normally, I will respond normally.
Steve, you've been doing this a long time, have probably been asked, I can only imagine, man, thousands of questions throughout the years. Do you get tired of talking shop? Do you get tired of talking about the church?
I don't, you know, I'm usually, I like talking to people. I like talking to people about the church. It's my life's work. you know, some stuff I'm over talking about under the Milky Way, and you know, some, you know, every now and then you meet someone who goes, I saw you guys in 1984 in Kansas City, and it's like, yeah, you know, I don't know what to say to that. But every now and then you meet someone who's got something really interesting to say about the whole thing, and I'm very happy to talk about that.
Okay, nice. So you said every now and then somebody will have something interesting to say about the whole thing. Give me an example of that, Steve.
Every now and then when we release a new record, there are fans who write reviews of the record, and I'm often amazed by how some of them can eloquently tell me what I did. They can reflect back what I did and why it was good or bad. So I'm always surprised, especially by people who don't speak English as their first language, who can sometimes really nail what the lyrics, the implications of the lyrics. I'm amazed by the things fans come up with, you know. But you don't have to. If I meet someone and they just go, "Oh, I really like your music," you know, you don't have to have some big revelation to impress me at all. But, you know, every now and then someone comes up with something really brilliant, talks about a song I'd forgotten about and goes, notices some small detail, and I'm always impressed by that.
Very cool. What about meet and greets, Steve? I could imagine that probably gets pretty tiring. Is that something that you enjoy?
No, not really. Some days there's a very, very, very long day and you've traveled all night and you get somewhere and you do a long, exhausting sound check, which is noisy and all of that. And then, you know, you've got an hour to yourself and then you've got to meet a whole bunch of people. I don't always enjoy it. I'm not always, you know, sometimes, it's hard to meet 60 people. And there's always the thing, you know, you've got, you know, I remember one night in Florida, there were about 80 people there and the person running it said, you've got 40 seconds with each person. And the first guy I met was in a wheelchair and he said, you know, I got my legs blown off in the Gulf War and your music got me through what happened. What are we going to say to him? Oh, great, I've only got 40 seconds to talk to you. So you spend 20 minutes talking to that guy and then suddenly there's all these unhappy customers that are going, I fucking paid $100 to meet him and he didn't even get to talk to me. That sort of, you know, that aspect of it can be kind of frustrating. And, you know, every now and then, you know, you meet a real turkey. I was at a gig one night and there's a guy there about 7'8" and he picked me up. I said, fucking some young guy picked me up. Put me down. He wouldn't put me down. No, I want to get a picture of you. It sounds funny. But to me, I'm like, I was furious. And I was like, put me down. This is totally fucking inappropriate. And the guys got hold of me and my feet are like a foot off the ground. And he's mates fucking around with the camera because, of course, no one knows how to use their camera on their fucking iPhone when they're taking pictures. And the guy's just picking me up and he's going, I go, put me down, you motherfucker, put me down. He's going, when he's taking the picture, I will. And, yeah, stuff like that. It's like, you know, you don't go around picking up 65-year-old men.
Oh, man, it's actually pretty damn rude.
It's totally fucking rude. You know, I'm not an old piece of liver in a butcher shop. You know, there's a lot of touchy-feely stuff, you know, women grab my ass and, you know, there's some of it's awkward and weird, but usually, you know, 95% of the time it's okay and it's all right. Every now and then there's somebody exceptionally lovely or there's somebody exceptionally rude and stupid, but most of the time it's okay and I don't really mind. And it's just the way the music biz is now. You know, people want to meet and greet. And they want to do it, and we do it. But sometimes I'm not really in the mood for it. Sometimes I'd rather have a rest and think about the gig, but it sort of helps us tour America to have this extra income stream, you know. Sometimes when you have a lot of people, you can almost make more from the meet and greet than you can from the gig itself. So
really, wow.
Yeah.
Man, Steve, there is a lot of stuff going on apparently at the meet and greets that I didn't know about. So wait a minute, man. Let me get this straight. You got women grabbing your ass at the meet and greets?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's sort of, you know, women get in their 50s and 60s and they sort of, you know, they sort of lose their inhibitions and they have a few drinks while they're waiting to meet and greet. And then, you know, they're sort of touching you inappropriately. Well, you know, that I'd rather women were touching me inappropriately than blokes were picking me up.
Yeah, no doubt.
And sometimes people shake my hand and, you know, I've got small hands that are very important to me to playing. And when some idiot, great big fucking cowboy from Minnesota shakes my hand and crushes my hand, I don't like that either.
Oh, wow, man, that is funny. Yeah, I don't think I'd like that either. Steve, I want to go back to something that you mentioned, which was you met a guy at a meet and greet who was in the Gulf War. He had lost both his legs. He expressed to you that your music and your lyrics and the church is what got him through the situation that he was going through. As an artist, how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel humble. It makes me feel like I started off doing something to make money, pick up girls and take drugs and see the world. And over the course of this long 40-year period, it's turned into much more than that, and that I have a responsibility to people who have really discovered something in my music. And when someone tells me something like that, or that there's a guy who passed away, and he was from Delaware. He was a lovely guy and he had a catheter permanently stuck in his arm and he had kidney disease and he said he had to have his blood changed a couple of times a week and he had to, you know, while his blood was being changed, he listened to the church. I met a brain surgeon who said he has to operate for 8 hours on someone's brain and when he operates on their brain, he listens to the church. I had a woman who was a zoologist who was in Africa, up a tree in the middle of a jungle, hundreds of miles from the nearest place, and she listened to the church while she was in her treehouse. I had a guy who was a ranger in outback Australia, thousands of miles from anyone, you know, driving along in the middle of the desert. He listens to the church. All of these things are incredibly important to me. And move me and fill me with wonder that something I started off never thinking that I was going to do anything like that. I just thought I was going to make some pop music and have some fun and meet some girls and go around America and, you know, wear fancy clothes and have a good haircut and all of that. And now at the age of 65, there are people who really, and sometimes children, sometimes there are young people bring their kids along and the kids really love it and the kids really look up to me and the parents and the kids have bonded over my music and what I do. All of this stuff is really important to me and I'm humbled. I'm really humbled by it. I'm not saying that. It's like it's so much more than I ever thought. It's something I never foresaw. So
when you were younger, Steve, did you realize that you were touching people that way? Or does a lot of that have to do with age?
As I get older and older, it's more apparent. You know, when I was 27, 28, I wasn't sort of touching their lives so much as impressing them or giving them something cool to listen to. But now at this stage of the game, I realize it's a lot more than that. And as I get older and older, I realize the incredible thing that I have touched people's lives and also the responsibility that comes with that, that it's I've made a difference and I've helped people through hard times and I've shared good times with them and you know, there are people I will never even know about who right now are walking down a street in Uruguay or Hungary or somewhere in fucking Charlotte, Carolina, whoever they are, and they're listening to me and digging it, and I'll never even know about it. You know, the ones I hear about are the tip of an iceberg. And it's beautiful. It's wonderful. What could you want? It's more important than money. It's something you can't buy with money, to have had that effect on people. And it means my dreams of being a songwriter have come true. And the songs that I write, you know, with a judicious combination of words and music and singing and production, it's making a difference to people, making people happy, and that's just mind-blowing. And I can't think about it too much or I'd get a big ego and then that would undo it all. So I try and be as gracious and as humble and grateful as I can be about that and not trying to overprocess it.
Yeah, man, that's a really great story and very cool that you're able to touch people's lives through your music and through your words. And it's also cool that you're aware of it and that you are humbled by it. Very cool, Steve. Earlier in our conversation, you had mentioned that prior to the church, you had written over 1,000 songs. What is that count up to today?
2,000.
Wow.
There's 1,000 songs no one will ever hear. And then there's the 1,000 songs that you can hear. I mean, if you wanted to sit down and get everything, you probably could find 1,000 songs out there that you could actually get somehow and listen to. It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's incredible, man. Steve, if you were to look at your body of work and all the songs that you've written, what can you say is a damn good song? What do you look at, or can you look at a particular song and go, you know what, that's a damn good song right there?
I think anything on Priest Equals Aura. I think anything on Untitled 23, Hotel Womb, obviously Under the Milky Way is a damn good song. You know, For a Moment with Strangers is a damn good song. Stuff on my solo records, when I've collaborated with people, you know, the songs I wrote with Martin Kennedy and the songs I will go on writing with Martin Kennedy, you know, he's provided the music, but I put the melody and the lyrics on top. I think they're damn good songs. I think with the exception of about 4 or 5, almost all my songs are damn good songs, or I wouldn't let them out if they weren't damn good songs.
And you mentioned Martin Kennedy. Martin Kennedy, founding member of the group All India Radio, you guys teamed up and formed Kilby Kennedy. Some of the stuff that you've done, Steve, of all of the work that you've done out there, some of my favorite is certainly what you have done with him from the Kilby Kennedy Project. Absolutely fantastic music. Steve, I want to go back to 1990 and talk about probably my favorite church CD album, whatever you want to call it, which is Gold Afternoon Fix, and why you dislike it so much.
It's not bloody awful. It's mediocre. And Starfish was a great record. It all came together. We had the whole world at our feet. And we all stopped trying a bit. Richard kind of lost the plot a bit. Marty had a baby. You know, everybody wanted to be a songwriter. We were divided. Our manager divided us. And instead of coming in with the killer punch that would have been Priest Equals Aura, where we went, bang, you like Starfish? We trod water and we sort of made an adequate, mediocre, okay record. It wasn't a great record. It wasn't as good as Starfish. It wasn't as good as Priest Equals Aura, which was a masterpiece. It was just okay, and okay wasn't good enough. And really, you know, it should have been amazing. And we were too busy fighting, bitching, chasing girls, taking drugs, having a party, working our own agendas, doing our own solo albums. And it's like the thing that the cohesion that held us together before we made it, when we made it, everyone became arrogant, complacent, and we sort of fell apart a bit.
Yeah, I hear you. And, you know, the fans out there know that it's not one of the band's favorite records, but there are definitely some Gold Afternoon Fix fans out there. You can go on the message boards and people will speak very highly of Gold Afternoon Fix.
Good. Look, no, I'm glad people like it, but obviously history concurs with me. We had a very successful record with Starfish, and we had a hit, and the record sold, went on to sell over 1 million copies. And Gold Afternoon Fix, we were treading water. We didn't improve on Starfish. There's some great songs on there. There's some filler.
What would you say some of the great songs are off of Gold Afternoon Fix?
I like Pharaoh. I like Grind. And then the whole thing with Richard happened, which isn't an easy thing to explain. If I had my time again now, when Waddy Wachtel started picking on Richard, I would have stuck up for Richard. And I would have said, leave him alone. Let him fucking play the drums the way he wants to. Because he was a brilliant improvisational drummer and he was a wild drummer. He was like Keith Moon. And suddenly we entered this era where everything was done to metronomes and click tracks and, you know, all the focus was on him. And he shouldn't have had that. I should have stuck up for him. We all should have stuck up for him more and not let him be bullied out of the band. But having said that, he'd lost interest. He'd lost interest in being in the band, and it was time for him to go. And when J.D. Doherty joined, it was a great kick up the arse to have a really serious, full-on drummer that really took the gig seriously. You know, when we were writing the songs for Gold Afternoon Six, Richard was fucking around. Richard was sort of like, and he was undermining morale. I remember him sitting there one day on a couch with some drums near him, sitting back on a couch, occasionally leaning forward and hitting the drums and sort of laughing at us as we were trying to write songs and undermining morale. And I don't like that. When I'm writing a song, I want serious. I want people to be serious about it. And he lost interest in it. And good luck to him. He lost interest and he got kicked out or he left, whatever. Waddy Wachtel picked on him. It all got complicated and vicious cycle where one thing, he lost more interest and then Waddy would pick on him more and then he'd lose more interest. And that was the end. You know, he was brilliant when he joined and he sort of, after Starfish, he started fucking around and not taking it seriously. I don't like that. When I play, take it fucking seriously. I don't like that sort of attitude. I want, when I go on stage, I want to deliver. I don't want their fucking girlfriends telling me what we can do and what we shouldn't do. And he brought his girlfriend on the road and the girlfriend was, you know, we'd get a playing at the Beacon Theatre, 3,000 people in New York, and we're getting ready to go on for the encore, and the girlfriend's going, you're not going to do another one, are you? And it's like, you know, I don't want that, you know. You know, if you think your girlfriend's more important than the guys in the band, get the fuck out. And he did, and that was the end of it. And, you know, good luck to him.
Yeah, and there you have it, game over. Steve, you mentioned Waddy Wachtel. For the people out there who don't know, Waddy Wachtel produced Gold Afternoon Fix. I like the songs that you mentioned off of that album, Steve. A couple of my favorites are Fading Away, Laughing. And of course, you can't mention Gold Afternoon Fix without mentioning Metropolis, another fantastic song off of that album. Steve, I know you don't like talking about Under the Milky Way, but want to circle back around to it real quick. The story goes, Clive Davis heard it. That was it. He knew it was a hit. Steve, how does that happen? How does he know that?
That's what he does. He's got the ears. He's got the ears, hasn't he? He's got the famous ears. He hears stuff like that. He heard it and he went, that's the hit. And it was, and he made it happen. That's what he did. He could hear hits. That's why he had the long, successful career. You can't have a career in the record business if you don't have a good pair of ears. And he heard it and he made it happen. He made it happen anyway, but it was a great song. But I reckon almost any song you like, if Clive Davis or someone like him said, I want that song to be a hit, the record company would pull out all stops to make it a hit.
That's pretty cool. And what were you thinking at that point in time, Steve, when he says, Steve, this is it, this is the hit, what's going through your mind?
I thought, really? And I went, okay. And as all the minions walked out after him, after he'd made that pronouncement, they all said, it's going to be a hit, Steve. And I was like, well, I'm looking forward to that. And they made it happen. And I was very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And at that point, Steve, with that hit, how much did life change for the church?
Well, a lot. Suddenly we were, you know, playing to bigger places and making more money and more hassles and more drugs and more girls and more travel and more arguments and more everything. You know, it really upped the ante. And, you know, people going, you got to write another song like that, which is a very hard thing to do. You know, it's like hard when people go, you got to write another song like that, but not like that. That's the sort of thing that drives you mad. Everything changed after we had that big hit, in good and bad ways. You know, personal relationships fell apart, new ones were formed, you know, more money, more stupidity, more excess, more pressure, better hotels, you know, business class on the planes, you know, everything changed after that.
Gotcha. How are the royalties from Under the Milky Way?
They're good. It's not as much as you think. And I sort of did some bad deals, but it brings me in a pretty good whack every year.
Nice. So explain how this works, Steve. Let's say, I don't know, as an example, McDonald's comes to you or somebody shooting a movie and a studio comes to you and they say, we want to use Under the Milky Way. Who gets that money and who decides on whether or not it gets used?
Well, I'm supposed to approve it. I'm supposed to say, yes, you can use it for your ad. I'm supposed to say, yes, you can put it in your film. And then the publishing companies do their best to fiddle me out of as much of that as they can by doing tricky little sub-publishing deals. And eventually, you know, my bit trickles down to me. But, you know, like they do their best to get as much as they can before it gets to me. But so I'm supposed to approve it. If McDonald's wanted to use it, if something unethical that I didn't believe in wanted to use it, but they're offering me a lot of money, then I would have a real moral dilemma on my hands. When Ford wanted to use it, there was no moral dilemma because I'm going, yeah, that's great. Ford cars, I love Ford, you know. Or if someone wants to use it to advertise spoons or, you know, tourism in fucking somewhere, I'm down with that. I haven't had the moral dilemma where something really unethical has come along, something I don't believe in, that are going to offer me a lot of money. You know, I always say to the rest of the guys in the band, what would you do if Donald Trump rang up and said, Under the Milky Way is my favorite song. When I'm re-elected, I'm having a party and I'm going to give you guys 500 grand to come along and play Under the Milky Way. And I say, what will happen then? And that hasn't happened yet and maybe never will. But when that happens, I'll have to weigh up the money and the, especially something like McDonald's, when everybody knows I'm very active with being, yeah, not being anti-meat, but, you know.
Yeah, McDonald's might not have been the best example to use since you're a vegan.
No, but it would be. If McDonald's came along and said, we're going to pay you $1 million to use Under the Milky Way, what would I do? And I don't know.
Yeah, I gotcha.
I really don't know. And everybody has a price. And if some unethical organization offered me enough money, I might have to go, fuck my ethics, I need the money.
Yeah, man. I hear you. You're right. Everybody does have a price. Steve, not sure if you're aware of this. I'm sure you are. During the Super Bowl,
Man,
they were going from the game into a commercial, and they played about 5 seconds of Under the Milky Way. People on the church message boards went pretty nuts over it because they got to hear 5 seconds of Under the Milky Way on the Super Bowl. Did you know about that? And do you get any sort of money or any sort of residual off of that?
I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck. So what? They played the fucking bagpipe solo. Yeah, I guess I'll earn some money from that. I don't know. I guess I do. That's how it's supposed to work. And the more people, so if your song is played to 30 people watching community TV in buttfuck Texas, you earn 1 cent. And if your song is played to 50 million Americans, or like on New Year's Eve when I did it, and 200 million people in China saw me sing Under the Milky Way, we're talking some serious money there. But because of the way I can't, you know, I don't check up on it. I just get my check and I don't read, you know, you get this great big printout or this email with 900, it was used here and here and here and here and here. I don't look at all that. I just go, where's the fucking check? And whatever it is, I go, all right, that's it. I don't, you know, I'm not going to be pouring through my very complicated and hard to read royalty statements trying to find out how much I got from the Super Bowl. And I don't, you know,
I hear you. People were excited by that.
Yeah, everybody was excited by that. And, you know, it wasn't even the song. It was the fucking stupid bagpipe bit. So it was a sort of a strange mixed blessing, the whole thing. But, you know, you think.
So you don't basically care if it was played or not.
No, I don't give a fuck about the Super Bowl. I don't even understand American football.
Oh, man.
And I don't really care, you know.
One thing about you, Steve, man, you're a straight shooter. But Steve, let me ask you this, man. What's wrong with the bagpipes and Under the Milky Way? I don't get it.
It's just stupid. It's just a stupid thing, you know.
No, I really don't know. What exactly is wrong with the bagpipes?
Nothing. You know, that is what it is. That is what it is. It's been like that. I don't fucking care. It was just at the time I did it as a joke.
Really? I didn't know that.
You know, yeah, it was a joke. There was that gap in the song. I was actually going to write something really beautiful and put in there, something really show off my musicality and what I could do.
Well, I mean, it certainly works, that's for sure.
It does, because you've heard it a million times. But when I did it, you know, and it's not only just a bagpipe, it's an African bagpipe, and it's a backwards sample.
Who's playing the bagpipe?
So I don't fucking know. It was off a machine. And then we made it go backwards. Me and the guy who was putting that song together, we played it backwards just to make it even more silly. And everybody loved it. So there you go. It's like, you know, it was a joke in 1987. I don't care anymore about that.
That's so funny to me, man. That's a fantastic story, Steve. Absolutely fantastic. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
From the time that you guys formed up until the present time, have you ever held a regular 9-to-5 type job?
When I left school, I got a job in the public service, and I was a clerk, and I had an ordinary job, which I wasn't very good at. And I quit when I was about 23 and moved to Sydney and took up screen printing. I used to screen print T-shirts and sell them at markets. I don't think I'd be very good at a regular job. I'm disruptive. I'm lazy. I'm a dreamer. I can't concentrate on things I'm not interested in. I'm irresponsible, flaky, insubordinate. I'm everything you wouldn't want in an employee.
Right.
Is all rolled into one guy in me. I would be a I'd be a terrible guy to have working for you.
Yeah, that's good stuff, man. I can't quite see you being the 9-to-5 type guy, Steve. One thing that I wanted to mention to you, one thing that I've noticed about the band is that you guys are very, very approachable. Have you guys always been that way?
I think if you had met us in 1988, we might not have been quite as approachable. You know, Marty certainly had his moments of saying ridiculous things, you know, and we used to bitch about each other. We used to bitch to each other, and we used to bitch about each other when we met fans. And, you know, sometimes I wasn't approachable, but, you know, there are a lot worse people to meet than us. You know, we weren't always the nicest people, and sometimes we used to have journalists and people in record companies and stuff on and make fun of them and have a little, you know, a little game going on. But, you know, all that's over. That's all gone. That's all 30 years. That's why I hate seeing someone going, you know, you're a turd because of something you did in 1986. It's 34 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. Steve, looking back on all of it, right, is there anything that you wish you would have done differently?
I wish I had always been as nice as I think I am now. And I wish when I'd gone in and done interviews in radio stations, if the guy wasn't as hip as I hoped, I wish I'd treated them with more respect and more compassion than I did. I sometimes went in there, and if someone I thought was an idiot, I would sort of make fun of them and send them up and say things they didn't understand. I wish I hadn't done all that, but I don't agonize over it either. I don't lie in bed at night going, oh, in 1986, a guy asked me for an autograph and I gave him a zigzag paper. Yeah, but, you know, if I come to think of it, you know, people grow up. You know, you'd expect at 65 you'd have more common sense and have a bit more grace and understanding than a guy of 25 or 26 who's just, you know, on top of the charts and making a load of money. You know, that's not always a good recipe for being the nicest person in the world. But there was no excuse. You know, when I was rude, when I was arrogant, when I was a tyrant, when I was bossy and sulky and all the rest of it, I'm not proud of that. You know, I'm on some scale of autism or Asperger's, I probably am. I was very, very good at what I did. I was good at writing songs. I was good at, you know, making music and producing records, and I had insight into that. But I was, as a human being, I left a bit to be desired. But I think that might come with the territory. And I've met a lot of other famous singers and writers and actors, and they always seem, you know, if you're really good at something, sometimes that means you're lacking in some other department.
That's a pretty interesting thought. If you're really good at something, you're lacking in some other department. Interesting. Steve, wanted to ask you, back at the height of your career, back at the height of the Church, the Under the Milky Way days, right? You hear about it all the time. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Back then, at the height of your career, was it literally sex, drugs, and rock and roll?
Yeah.
Well, that was without hesitation. Really?
Yeah, of course it was. Of course it was when you were a young man. That's what I want. That's why I got into it for. I got into it for sex, drugs, and money. You know, and there was sex, drugs, and money to be had. And very easy. You didn't have to put any work into it. You know, it was all, you know, most guys have to go out and hustle for sex, drugs, and money. You know, I just walk off stage and there was sex, drugs, and money. I wasn't as bad as you think I might have been. I didn't sleep with every woman that I had an opportunity to. You know, I wasn't a complete slut. But, you know, I availed myself. When something nice came along, I availed myself of it.
Hear ya. Once again, appreciate the honesty. Steve, wanted to ask you about, I don't know, man, maybe some of the bands that you would have crossed paths with back in the day at the height of the Church's career. Two bands that come to mind would be NXS and Echo and the Bunnymen. Any stories about those guys and any stories about maybe some other bands that you've come in contact with through the years?
NXS were nice guys. Echo and the Bunnymen were kind of standoffish and didn't interact with us much. I could never understand what Ian McCulloch was saying. His accent was so thick. Whenever I talked to him, which wasn't very often, he was like, "Oh, you fucking!" It's like, "What the fuck?" You might as well be talking Greek. His accent was so thick. I met Julian Cope. I really liked him. I met Iggy Pop. He was the loveliest, kindest, most humble guy. I didn't really hang out with a lot of other bands and musicians. Most people were okay. You know, none of them were really terrible. Tom Mullane was an interesting guy. I was all friendly with him. He was an interesting guy. J.D. Doherty was a lovely human being. Bob Clearmountain, the producer, was an incredible, lovely guy. So was Peter Walsh, and so was Gavin McKillop.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of names there, Steve. Bob Clearmountain, a guy that's worked with a ton of bands like Simple Minds, Bon Jovi, Toto, and Bruce Springsteen. J.D. Doherty, of course, former drummer of your band, The Church, from 1990 to 1993. Steve, wanted to ask you about another band and another guy, as I have always been a big fan of Catherine Wheel, lead singer Rob Dickinson. How was he, and do you still talk to him?
Yeah, he did a tour with us. He was a gentleman. He was a real English gentleman. It was a lot of fun having him on tour. We were sort of friends, but when the tour was over, I never saw him again. You know, Robin Hitchcock, same thing. I did a tour with him in Australia. We used to hang out a bit and talk about music and life and stuff. And the tour ended, and I never heard from him again. And okay, you know, you were just ships in the night. You're just like builders on a building site. You know, you get together, you build the house, it's over. And most people are pretty cool. Most people are pretty nice. Yeah, you know, there's very few real idiots and villains, you know.
Yeah, that's cool to know that everybody for the most part is pleasant. Robin Hitchcock, former member of the Soft Boys in the late 70s, early 80s. Steve, wanted to circle back around really quickly to NXS. I mentioned them earlier. You talked about them briefly. Just curious, man, did you have, obviously, a huge Australian band? Did you have any sort of contact with those guys at the height of NXS's career and at the height of your career?
We didn't really have a lot to do with them. We didn't really see them a lot. In very early on, before they were very successful, I met Michael in a recording studio, and He wanted to be friends with me, and I was, for whatever reason, I sort of was cold and rude, and I really reject that. I really angry with myself. I did that. I couldn't be friendly. Nowadays, anybody comes up and wants to be my friend in the music business, I'd be their mate. But in those days, I was sort of like, I don't know, you know. And he made some overtures of friendship, and I didn't respond, but we didn't really have a lot to do with them. And then, you know, we rarely crossed paths. We're kind of insular, you know. When we did festivals and when we did double bills or whatever, we still pretty much kept to ourselves.
What's your take on Michael Hutchins as a performer?
He was an amazing performer. He was incredible. He was a rock star. I don't listen to his records. I don't think he's a great lyricist or anything, but he was an incredibly charismatic guy, and he had a sad story about how it all went down. And I took no pleasure out of that. I was very envious of his success. You know, he had a lot more drugs, women, and money than I ever had. You know, then it all went wrong, and, you know, I saw the movie, and I saw that movie made about him. I really felt sad, and I realized I hadn't understood a lot of stuff that was happening to him, and I had a lot of sympathy and compassion.
Yeah, man, certainly a sad story. And I know for me, I've always been a fan of NXS. Steve, when you guys were in Boston a couple of years ago, I guess it was now, you and I were having coffee in Starbucks. You had to leave because you were going to the venue to meet your patron. I didn't exactly know what a patron was, and you explained it to me. For the listeners out there who don't know what a patron is, Explain what a patron is and how many patrons the church has.
We have a couple of patrons, and we wouldn't be able to do anything without them. We wouldn't be able to make records. We wouldn't have been able to make one record since, after everything now this on, all of our records have been paid for by our main patron, Kevin Lane Keller, who's a professor. And then further deeper, and the record we're making now, were paid for or are being paid for by Kit McClanahan, who is my personal friend and my personal patron. But we wouldn't be able to do anything without those guys. So if you're listening to a church record from after everything on, realize that there was someone who reached into their pocket to make that record possible, because we wouldn't be able to make records without patrons.
Well, damn, thank goodness for those guys, or there'd be no church records. So how does that work, Steve? Those guys just finance the whole deal? Is that how that works?
Well, wouldn't you do that?
If I had the money, certainly.
Say you had as much money as you could possibly use, and you've heard that your favorite band or your favorite author or your favorite football team or whatever it is was struggling. Wouldn't you chuck some money in to keep them going?
Yeah, like I said, if I had the money, I certainly would. I think it would be a really cool thing to do. But I'm curious as to how that process works. I mean, do these guys just approach you and say, hey, man,
yeah,
we dig what the church are doing. We want to give you some money. We want to help finance
it. Yeah. And
how does that process work?
The night I met Kevin Keller, he said, back in the 90s, he came up and said, I'll write you a check for 20 grand right now if you don't believe me. Because I was very skeptical. He said, I want to help you guys out. I'm like, yeah. But, you know, if I was a rich guy, I would be a patron too. If I could afford it and I saw somebody I really believed in struggling, I reckon I'd chuck in some money. And that's what decent people do with their money. They you know, when they've got everything they need, they help out the people they believe in. And I think that's always been the case and probably always will be. I think people who've got a lot of money and then have everything they need. They've got the houses and the cars and everything. And they got a bit of cash left over and they see an artist they believe in having a struggle. I think they will help out.
Very cool. Those are a couple of good guys for sure. Steve, whenever I talk to you, I always like to ask you about certain bands and get your opinion on other bands. I always find it interesting and it's usually pretty damn funny, man. So can I ask you about a couple of bands right now?
Yeah.
And get your opinion on those bands?
Sure.
Cool. You ready?
Yeah.
Here we go. Rush.
I couldn't tell you one Rush song. A lot of people, I know some weird fans whose two favorite bands are The Church and Rush. And didn't one of Rush pass away recently?
Yeah, the drummer, Neil Peart.
The drummer. Oh, look. I have almost no opinion on Rush. I have no wish to hear them. I have no wish. I don't hate them, but I'm not in. They don't pique my interest at all. So pass. No opinion.
Okay, moving right along. Van Halen.
Hate them.
Journey.
Rubbish. What do you think I? Seriously, what do you think I think of Journey? What? Why would I fucking like something like that?
Oh man, here we go.
Well, why? Well, you know, it's obvious. If it's obvious,
I mean, possible guilty pleasure, Steve.
It's obvious. No. It's obvious if you say Van Halen and Journey and Kansas and Styx, I'm going to say I hate them. And if you say Television and Patti Smith and, you know, whoever the fuck, I'm going to say I love them. It's, you know, everybody knows who I like and who I don't like. No, I don't like those. I don't like heavy metal at all. I don't like heavy metal. I don't like power ballads. I don't like Foreigner. I don't, you know, obviously, I don't like Loverboy.
Oh, man. Who do we get there? We got Foreigner, Styx, Kansas, Loverboy. Oh, man, that's great. Steve, here we go. Def Leppard and Skid Row.
No, rubbish, rubbish, stupid. Stupid stuff. Why even ask me?
Because, man, to get this type of response from you, it's funny.
Cartoon music.
Oh, man, Steve, that's so great. All right, here we go. I'm going to get serious with you, for real. I was just joking around. Here we go. U2.
Okay, U2. Now that's an interesting one. I think some of U2's songs are fucking amazing. I think With or Without You, Streets Have No Name, All I Want Is You. I love some of the things Edge. I think Edge dreamed up a whole new way of playing the guitar with his, you know, his ching 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 ching. Like, but then Bono goes and ruins it with his sort of proselytizing and holier than thou. And but mixed feelings. I think they have written some undeniably fantastic, powerful songs, and some of them I really like. I could probably have one CD that have all my favourite U2 songs on it, and I'd really enjoy listening to it. But some of the others, like One Love, One Love, you know, that pisses me off. That sort of, you know, and I can't exactly say why, this sort of seriousness with which Bono takes himself, I don't dig, you know, and I respect them. They're not rubbish, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. Steve, give me your take on Morrissey and the Smiths.
I think the early Smiths, first few Smiths records were really good. He's a singer who wrote some good lyrics and had a good band and had his moment.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with you on that. The early Smith stuff is pretty damn good. Steve, how about Robert Smith, lead singer of The Cure? Have you ever met him?
I haven't met him, but he invited us to be part of his Meltdown Festival a couple of years ago.
Yep, I knew that.
And I was looking forward to meeting him. I have a lot of respect for him. The Cure isn't my favorite band, but I certainly have a lot of respect for them. And some of their songs and his take on the whole thing, I've got a lot of time for. I was looking forward to meeting him. And we came off stage and there was a bottle of champagne and a note saying, I'm sorry I couldn't meet you. I had a family emergency. And I was saddened by that. And I wish I could say I hung out with Bobby Smith and we jammed on six string bass, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, that would have been really cool. That's a band that I definitely like a lot, The Cure. Steve, this is why I like talking to you about musicians and bands, because you never know who you're going to say you like, who you don't like. I heard in an interview with you that the next guy you really like, and to me it seems very random, and how and why you like this guy is going to be interesting to know why. Benjamin Orr, bassist and vocals for The Cars.
I love Benjamin Orr. I love Benjamin Orr. I feel like if I had known him and I would have been friends. I look at his face and I go, there's something in his face that really attracts, not in a gay way, but I feel like him and I could have been mates. And I like his demeanor. I liked his singing. I was really sad when he died, and I was really sad when Rick died. The Cars, I didn't like everything they did, but they had a couple of really great songs and they had a great take on music. When Benjamin died prematurely of pancreatic cancer, I was living in America, and my wife, Natalie, at the time, came in and told me. I was really fucking sad. I really felt like I'd lost a mate. And then when I read Rick died last year, it made me very sad, disproportionately to how much I loved their music. So I, you know, The Cars aren't the first thing I reach for in the morning when I want to hear some music, but I think they were really decent and nice guys. And I think I would have been friends with them if we'd ever met.
Very cool, man. Steve, new Church album is coming out. Ashley Naylor is now part of the band. Tell me a little bit about Ashley's part and tell me about the album.
Yeah, we made a new album. We're still working on it. We're still finishing it off. We're still figuring how to do it. I think it's really good. Ashley Naylor's contributed a lot. I think it's got some good stuff on there. It's very dreamy. It's very trippy. It's very psychedelic. I think it's as good as anything else.
Nice. Certainly looking forward to that. And thanks to the patrons, by the way. Steve, when will that be released?
We're aiming for June or July.
Fantastic. And will you guys tour to support the album?
We're touring Europe in May and June, and we're going to tour the States in August and September. And then we're going to come back and do a tour of Australia at the end of the year.
Awesome. New church music and a tour. You can't beat that. Steve, really quickly, explain to the people out there that you have no say on where you guys go, because a lot of times you'll see on social media, please come to, you know, whatever city it may be. And that is all handled through a booking agent, correct? And you have nothing to do with that.
No. We have a booking agent in America, and we have one in Europe, and they go, you're going here, and you're going here, and you're going here, and you're going here, and you're playing this place, and this place, and this place. And I go, okay, tell me where to go. I have no say if I will go to Asheville or Charlotte or Raleigh. You know, it's like if someone sends me there, I'll go. Then if I don't, it's pointless to say, come here, come to South America. It's not up to me. I don't decide that. We will go to South America when a promoter in South America offers us enough money to do it. We go to cities in America where someone wants to see us. We don't, you know, if nobody wants to come and see us in a particular city, we probably won't go there, or we'll only go there once and it doesn't work out and we don't go back. But I myself have never had any say in where we go. And one day I'll get an email and it'll go, this is where you're playing, these are the clubs you're playing at, and it's all been decided. And I'm okay with that. I don't bother myself with, you know, sometimes I get to places and go, why the fuck are we playing here? But, you know, ahead of time, I just take however it rolls out.
Gotcha. Steve, last question, and then we are out of here, man. I really do appreciate your time. Favorite cities in America that you like to play?
Yeah, I like LA. I like Portland. I like Seattle. I like Chicago. Obviously, you know, Atlanta. I like the South. I like Texas. I love Texas. I love all the cities in Texas.
And you guys always seem to play Houston. You guys go to Houston a lot. The
Houston.
The Heights Theater.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys play, it seems, almost every time when you come to America.
Yeah, I like Houston. I like places where they like us. I have no opinion, really. I don't see much about it. Of a city, I see, you know, if I'm playing in this city, I usually roll up there at 10 o'clock in the morning on the bus. I, you know, find a cafe and have a vegetarian meal. I do the gig and I get in the bus and drive away. I don't have much opinion other than how much people liked seeing us. You know, we did a gig in St. Petersburg last year in Florida, and the audience loved us. So I love St. Petersburg. If they hadn't loved us, I probably wouldn't. So, yeah, it's kind of wherever they like us, that's where I like to be. I don't really want to be somewhere, even if it's a beautiful, like Paris is a beautiful city and it's got the Louvre and it's got all that. But the audiences don't really like us in Paris much and never have. And I see we're going there on our next tour, but it doesn't particularly bring me much joy. You know, I've got no interest in seeing museums or monuments or anything. You know, I'm not a tourist, and I never have been. You know, when I go to Madrid, I don't really want to go and see the blah 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 museum. I'm too busy coping with just having to do it.
Hear you, man. Steve, you are done. You can get out of here.
All right. Okay.
I really do appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. As always, your stories were fantastic. Any final words?
Thanks for having me on. Thanks for listening to me. Have me back in another year.
You got it, man. Deal. I will have you back on in a year. For everybody out there listening, I'll hook up Steve's social media platforms on my webpage at beingfamouspodcast.com. And remember, guys, while you're there, you can also listen to previous episodes. And if you like what you hear, please leave me a comment. That would be greatly appreciated. Hope you guys enjoyed my conversation with Steve Kilby. I will talk to you on the next podcast. Peace.